Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United on this Sunday night. My name is Jamie, and Jerry and Chris are here with us, my fellow movie geeks. Hi, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
It's good to be with everyone tonight. We got a great show tonight. We're going to talk about the latest movie releases, the latest headlines and movie news, and we're going to be talking film festivals with Tom Hall. And he is the director of programming for one of the top independent film festivals in North America, Sarasota Film Festival. And his job this year has just started. They're gearing up for their 10th year anniversary celebration in April, and he's getting submissions now, and it's quite a job. But I was actually looking through our past shows and how much this film festival has factored into some of our shows and some of the guests that we've had so far. From the films that they offered earlier this year, we've brought on Sophie Fiennes, who is the director of The Pervert's Guide to Cinema and the sister of, the famous Fiennes brothers.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We've brought on Anthony Giacchino and John Swinglish from the Camden 28. And
Joey Pants.
Joey Pants and Joseph Greco from Canvas. And Michael Schroeder, the director of Man in the Chair. And did I mention Craig Zobel, Great World of Sound?
We did him, yeah.
Yeah, and this Wednesday, actually, we have a special horror movie show. It's one of a couple that we're doing this month. And we're opening up the hour with Michael Berryman, the star of the original The Hills Have Eyes. And also, something else exciting I want to talk to Mr. Berryman about. He was in Cuckoo's Nest. Remember
That's
him
right.
in Cuckoo's Nest? Yeah. Yeah, he was in that. So there you have it. And we were also going to be speaking to Alex Orr, who is the writer-director of the new cult horror film Blood Car, which also premiered at the Sarasota Film Festival earlier this year. And then on Sunday, we have a great tribute to Kubrick. Next Sunday, the 21st, featuring interviews with one of the stars of Kubrick's last film, Eyes Wide Shut. Her name is Julian Davis, and the cinematographer for Eyes Wide Shut, Larry Smith. He also worked as a gaffer and I believe as another position on The Shining and Barry Lyndon. So that's going to be a great show. And then we have a Texas Chainsaw Massacre retrospective on the 24th, which is a Wednesday, a week from this Wednesday, with the cinematographer for both the original and the first remake of Chainsaw Massacre, Daniel Pearl, and also the director of the definitive documentary on the original film called The Shocking Truth. His name is David Gregory. And also, after those interviews conclude, we have the star of Saw 4, Lyric Bent. And I'm sure that'll do gangbuster business.
Oh, well. Yeah. I would really be surprised if it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, Lyric Bent, he's been in the past three now, starting from Saw 2, and he is the lead character in this one. He's the one, the character that this, whatever the maniacal plot all revolves around. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that's good. And we also have, throughout the month, we have some talent from the next 8 Films to Die For series. Did you attend any event last year, guys?
No, I didn't. No, it just, it plays at like one, I guess, theater around here. And they show, like, a couple films each day for that week, and then it disappears.
Yeah. It's just like a weekend.
It's a week. It's not even a week. It's just a weekend.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's eight films over the course of a weekend. And then they release them subsequently on video, which I'm sure they do gangbuster business on.
Yeah, you can get, like, a box set. No, they do very well. That After Dark, they do very well on video.
Yeah. So we have two directors lined up, I believe, for that series. Representing obviously 2 of the 8 films, and we're trying to get a spokesperson for that that show as well, or that series of films as well, from After Dark. So what's going on, guys? How have things been for the past week?
They've been all right, you know, just going, getting by, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. That's not the answer you wanted, but that's the answer I was giving.
That's about as exciting as it gets, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Okay.
I'm just getting started, baby.
Yeah, I hope so.
Don't worry. I'm still kind of perplexed by those boom mics in Elizabeth, okay?
That's right. You're watching the Elizabeth film, and you saw clearly boom mics.
I saw boom mics. It was very disconcerting.
I bet.
Well, that's to do with the framing of the movie, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and they had big issues with that.
Yeah, you can see on most movies, if you put them out of frame, you know, put the framing down, most movies you can see the boom mic.
I know, and it happened to me at the Chris Rock movie earlier this year, the same thing happened, and you're just like, and while I can understand it there, while you're watching a period piece, so it's very disconcerting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's so upsetting, too, because movie theaters, there's a lot of things that ruin the movie experience that are completely out of their control. The presentation is the one thing that is 100% in their control, and
yep.
they fuck it up time and time again.
Yeah.
Over again, yeah.
No excuse.
Yeah, and we can testify to that, Chris and I, because we came from the theater exhibition industry.
Right, but I also assume it seems like you guys knew what you were doing. It seems today, though, sadly...
We were the only ones, though.
Oh, okay. Okay, but no, it does seem, though, the one thing I always see, like, help wanted, they need projectionists, and the people, I don't think they understand or know what they're doing, but this actually is not an uncommon thing. I mean, this
right.
does happen from time to time.
Right, and we're talking about Kubrick here, and Kubrick really, he was aware of that, and he was aware of every theater... how they were formulated with THX systems and such, and he had a say in what theaters carried his movies. I mean, he was up in England, but he would call a theater in Oklahoma if they were showing the movie in the wrong format or in the wrong fashion.
I believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, they said that he was very much hands-on, like in a really, like, extreme...
I would hate to get that phone call in that theater.
Yeah, but, yeah, if you're thinking teenagers, I mean... I really don't know how many people at when I worked with the theater business, how many of our employees knew anything about anyone in films, unless it was, Britney Spears.
Oh, God.
Sad but true.
Yeah, it does seem that way, yeah.
Okay, our guest has not called in yet, so guess what I'm going to do?
20 questions?
No, I'm going to call him to give him a reminder that he needs to call in. I tried to email, and that didn't quite work. So I'm going to give him a call so we can get him online. So just talk amongst yourselves, guys.
So this is going to be a Letterman moment, okay.
No. I'm calling, yeah, I'm doing like Letterman. I'm calling my mother for a report from the Sears Olympics.
Or Regis Philbin, either one.
Yeah. Man, he really rags on Regis Philbin.
But I love when he does that. I love those shows are great when he rags
yeah,
on Regis.
Yeah, they really are. David Letterman, heads and tails above in terms of ability and comic timing and ability above Jay Leno, I think.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, but he's no Conan O'Brien. Come on.
You know, I kind of like Conan O'Brien. I kind of even like that Craig Ferguson guy.
Yeah, Chris.
What about Jimmy Kimmel?
Yeah, what about Jimmy Kimmel?
I like him. I mean, I don't watch him at all, but I like him. I mean, from what I've seen,
Well, none of them hold a candle to Carson Daly.
No.
So, we can.
No, you're right. You're right.
Okay, I'm about to call Tom Hall, our guest for the evening. And you'll notice, whenever you talk on the phone to someone that you don't know, it's kind of different here on the show when we bring on guests, but... How your voice, does this happen to you, your voice raises an octave when you're trying to be polite?
Hey, hey.
Yeah, yeah.
Make
yeah.
an impression? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if that's what happens to me.
Mr. Hall?
No, I'm kidding. All right, it's ringing.
Dun, dun, dun.
I wish I had my drum roll sound effect. Ringing a second time. Ring number three. You guys are doing really well at, keeping the conversation going.
Well, I'm thinking, hey, should we, like, you know, let you...
I got ideas for topics we could talk about here, but I don't want to get into something.
Yeah, I mean, what if he's there?
Yeah. Hey, how about that new Tyler Perry movie, huh?
That was number one.
Well, Jerry, you wanted to talk about something Jamie told me, specifically about George Clooney.
Hi, Mr. Hall. This is Jamie Duvall, the host of Movie Geeks United.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Michael Clayton.
Right.
I mean, I really...
I guess it didn't get through. But,
and, as we were, and it's really interesting, Jamie brought up earlier, we were talking and brought up Aaron Brockovich
40,
and in comparison, and it's very interesting that it's like Steven Soderbergh brought out these great performances for Julia Roberts in that movie, but also really elevated Clooney without a sight.
Completely.
And it's something about Soderbergh. He's able to bring out this magnetism that wasn't there before. And, I mean, it was there, but maybe not as, maybe not the right role, maybe not the right character, but he brought it out for those particular movies, and it changed their careers, I think, in a good way forever.
Well, both of them had a career strictly of audience-friendly movies before, but the difference is when you work with Soderbergh, he makes audience-friendly movies that are actually also for intellectuals.
That's
you know?
Very true.
It's not just Transformers, you know, and it's also not just Michael Clayton. Nothing against Michael Clayton, but it's a very much a movie for the thinking person. It's not necessarily an audience-pleasing movie, as Jamie was saying.
Right.
So, you know, like, thank God that George Clooney made Out of Sight, which is a really underrated movie.
Oh, very underrated. And while it got very good reviews, it wasn't, you know, didn't draw in the numbers.
Right.
Audiences, but it's a wonderful film.
How about the cast in that movie? I mean, it's unbelievable. And none of them were huge at the time, whether it was Don Cheadle or even George Clooney or Steve Zahn. It just goes on and on.
There's a lot of them. Who else was, you know, they, but it was good. They also had the veteran act, like Albert Brooks was good, and Dennis Farina.
Yeah, Dennis Farina.
And it's also
Michael
the
Keaton
one
had the little part in it.
Yeah, and there's also the one role I think that J-Lo was perfect for.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's never been better.
Yeah, and not before and not after. I mean, it's just right. She got it right for that part.
Yeah, she was a lot grittier in that than she was in Made in Manhattan, I felt.
She truly seemed tough in that movie. A lot of times in movies, they'll have these roles, like for Jodie Foster in The Brave One or something like that, where the woman is supposed to be tough, and
right.
Not that that's impossible, but it just doesn't seem very credible. J-Lo in Out of Sight, she truly seemed like she could wield that nightstick, you know, like she does and beats Isaiah Washington's ass with it. It's
yes.
Really incredible. Like,
yeah, and don't underestimate the power of chemistry. I mean,
absolutely.
That was some chemistry that worked right there between.
It worked perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's hard to cast. I don't know that you can cast it. I think you just leave it up to the gods, or you kind of
roll the dice. You know.
Yeah.
You hope.
You have to see them together. I don't know how that works. I can tell that some movies they just cast names where there's no chemistry. They
right.
cast names, and you can tell that they didn't spend any time together. Or the director didn't see them together prior to the shoot.
Right.
You know, because it's really hard to gauge, and you really have to spend time with them prior to the shoot to figure that out.
Well, Made in Manhattan, that's a perfect example. You've got two extremely charming people, J-Lo and Ralph Fiennes. And
yeah, he was very charming in Schindler's List.
Oh, yeah. Extremely
yeah, very
Nobody
charming
is
Amon Goth. Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
He truly is, though, you have to admit.
He's very good,
charming.
Yeah, yeah.
No, he's a, and I have to, I know a lot of people, I don't think he gets enough credit for some of the movies he's in, and especially that year when Made in Manhattan came out. I mean, he did that, Red Dragon, and Spider, three very different films.
I don't think you. I don't think he does enough. I don't know if he's not offered enough, if he's not offered a variety of roles or the kinds of projects that he wants. But we don't see him that often.
It seems like he does a lot of smaller movies. Like before that trio of films came out, he did a movie, Sunshine, that was very good. But
End of the Affair.
Chris, you love that movie, don't you?
I'm nuts about End of the Affair. Great
yeah.
movie.
Oh, that's a wonderful film.
He's great in Quiz Show, too. I mean,
He's perfect in Quiz Show.
He's an outstanding actor. And remember, after he broke through Schindler, he went and did Strange Days. Was his
That was very good, too. I mean,
yeah,
it was
like a
movie.
Great 180. from Schindler's List to Catherine Bigelow's film. We have a call on a 201 area code. I don't believe it's our guest because I think we're looking for our guest on a different area code.
Well, we'll see. Let's, you know, pick it up.
Let's take 201. Let's see. 201, go right ahead.
Hi, this is Alan Levy calling. How
hey,
are you?
Mr. Levy, how are you?
Good.
Safe?
I've been down here. I've been down this path.
Oh, with the guest not calling. Yeah.
Yeah, that happens occasionally.
It does. Hopefully,
it does.
I gave him until 6:40 to call in, so hopefully he will. But, you know, we've had so many guests on in the past, and they've all been so wonderful and accommodating.
You've had great guests. I want to say you guys are doing a great job. And, you know, I see a lot of very exciting things happening, and we're starting to reach out to some of the large agencies now to get some, you know, Blog Talk Radio will be on the circuit, you know, for people coming on, you know, doing either book tours, movies, and so on. I think it's a great platform for that.
No, it's great. Thank
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And all of our guests have just loved the format. They've loved how easy it is.
Right.
Yeah,
just pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an easy thing. We had Melinda Doolittle on, you know, from The Idol.
I listened to that, yeah.
And, you know, that was good. Got hundreds and hundreds of live listeners. And so there's a lot of good stuff. So I want to, we're profiling, you know, your show now on Zune and iTunes and other places. And we're going to start making an effort now that the site is up and we're kind of getting, you know, getting this part done to reach out and get some really A-grade hosts in that we can feed you and work together. So
I appreciate
we
all
appreciate
the support.
It. Thank you.
You guys have been great, and it's a great platform. It's so easy to use for, you know, somebody like me. I'm not computer savvy.
Right.
Don't. That's not true. Actually, you're much more computer savvy than you think. So don't even think that.
Well, thank you, Jerry. And I have very nice co-hosts. So thank you. But it's just a great service, and we appreciate all you guys do, and you guys spotlight us quite a bit, and we really appreciate all that work you're doing for
us. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Have a good night.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
That's Alan Levy, the CEO of Blog Talk Radio. It's a great service. You can host your own show on Blog Talk Radio. It's very easy to sign up. You can get on the air and just a finger snap, and to have your own show, it's just the coolest thing. It's even better when you have something to talk about. So.
Yeah, and we're talking about Mr. Fiennes, and
yes.
I guess maybe not to go back to George Clooney, and we're talking about Soderbergh, and I think he has a very, you know, he and Clooney have a very good working relationship. But I wanted to know, because we've never talked about it, or at least in terms of the show, what did the two of you think of The Good German?
You want to field that one, Jamie, or you want me to take it?
I did not see it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Jamie. I wasn't. No wonder we haven't talked
about
it.
You know that long stretch of silence after you asked that question? I think that's what we feel about The Good German.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and the reason I bring that up is also because of Cate Blanchett's character. And, you know, Cate Blanchett was in the Boom Mic movie, period piece, Elizabeth, this weekend.
Yeah.
And I was just curious because I'm I like both Soderbergh and Clooney a lot, but for this film, the only thing I could really walk away with, there are two things I liked. Thomas Newman's score, and I did like the character Clooney played, but just the rest of the movie just sort of fell flat for me.
You know, it struck me as an experiment, and like all kind of experiment movies, they're limited appeal, you know?
Yeah, it never went wide.
Yeah. Well, it's, when I say experiment, I mean they wanted to evoke Casablanca.
Oh, big time. And The Third Man.
And I think that was the modus operandi above all things, even, you know, a compelling story.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted to recapture that kind of style. It was acted in the same style, too, wasn't it?
There's a lot of truth in that statement. I thought it was, you know, and I love Soderbergh, but I thought he was obsessed with the technique.
Yeah.
Very obsessed with the technique.
Yes.
And he was like sort of at times going for Casablanca, and then at other times because of the Cate Blanchett character, going for like the Fassbinder films like Veronica Voss and The Marriage of Maria Braun. And then as we were talking about with the person from Criterion, The Third Man, had a huge...
I just want to ask, did you just call her Kate Blanchett?
I don't know what I called her.
I just want to point
yeah,
that out.
Yeah, good German, that was some...
So that's the kind of feeling I got from that movie. And you know, there was a different style of acting then. And it's what people don't realize. I mean, young people will watch the movies of the 30s and 40s now, and they'll think, oh my God, they're so overdone, they're overdoing it. But they came from the theater,
right?
And the theater at the time was very, obviously theatrical. It was projected to the back of the house,
right?
And a lot of that acting you see in the early half of last century was based on that. And so that's why they say that Brando is the father of modern movie acting. He's the one that first brought that kind of raw naturalism to the screen. And he, around the same time as James Dean. But Brando's the one that, really...
Brando's the
through.
One that, yeah.
Yeah, so... And you can't deny it. Brando was just a force. He was just a force of personality and just an incredible talent. And apparently he brought that same naturalistic intensity to the stage, too.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, which was revolutionary at the time. He started off on the stage. I think he did Streetcar on Broadway before he made a movie. And
right.
I remember Pauline Kael talking about being in the theater opening night. And the actor came on. No, this was a different play. This was before Streetcar, something cafe that Brando was in. And she bowed her head when he made an entrance. She didn't know who he was because she felt embarrassed for him. She thought that he was having a nervous fit on stage. But it was all the behaviorisms of the character. And no one had been accustomed to seeing that level of performance before, that commitment before. And so when she looked up, she just started to become totally absorbed after she got over the initial shock.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a documentary that came out a couple of years on Broadway, The Golden Age, and that's when they talk about Brando, I mean, they just say when he first came on, it was just like this, no one had seen anything like it.
If he would have stuck to theater, he could have...
Out of this world experience.
Yeah, he could have done theater a lot of good had he stuck with it. It's just like that Brando documentary that we watched earlier
back
in the year.
June or July, yeah.
Yeah, and they focused on Streetcar and everything that made him unique and special. So anyway.
So is there anybody like that today? Is there anybody that even compares that is in that category?
I don't think there's anyone as surprising.
I mean, there's never going to be anybody as influential, obviously, yeah. But is there anyone who you can put in that category?
I can put in, not in that category, I can put in actors that have a rawness to them, a raw a ferocity to them, but, a lot of people want to say Sean Penn. I mean, a lot of people want to put Sean Penn in that category. I like Sean Penn a lot, and I think the stuff that he's done, especially since Casualties of War, definitely warrants a special attention. I just don't know if there's anyone like Brando.
I think there are lots of actors that are...
Want to be him.
Well, I think there are lots of actors now that are that good, actually. And I think that the reason why Brando is singled out is because he was the first. And he made all of the great actors today really possible.
That's true.
Yeah, I think that they're tremendous actors. But there can only be one first.
Yeah. That's true. I would put, like you said, James Dean, and the other one I would put in that category is Montgomery Clift.
Yeah. Yeah, and who knows what James Dean might have done.
They say, the famous thing is if James Dean had lived, how do I say this without...
He would still be alive.
Well, no, thank you. No, if James Dean had he lived, Brando, there would never have been this poison period in Brando's life in the 60s because he would have been that was the competition.
He would have been competitive.
He would have been very competitive, but when Dean dies, that competitive edge slowly goes away.
Then again, look on the flip side. Maybe Dean's death is what made him legendary.
That's... Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously he produced great work, but it might be one of those cases of, you know, he died young after three films. And it's that question of, you know, he was so great. What did we miss from him that makes him so legendary and renowned?
Right.
What do you
but
think, Chris?
Those two guys, there wasn't a, and I hate to, you know, sound like I don't like either of them. I do like James Dean and I love Brando. But there wasn't a whole hell of a lot of range with Brando. While he was surprising and while he was extremely intense and he could surprise you inside of an individual performance, you either got, for the most part, you either got the brooding, intense character, the On the Waterfront or the Last Tango in Paris character, or you got the kind of the wild, bizarre character that you see in movies like Missouri Breaks or, you know, later on in Island of Dr. Moreau. That's not a great example, but they're very similar performances. He didn't have a lot of range. He didn't.
Well, I mean, you're talking about...
What's that?
You single out two types of performance, the serious and the comedic.
Right.
I mean, everyone's stuck with those limitations. But but he played Oriental. He played all different nationalities, just like Meryl Streep does now. And there's no performance like Last Tango. There's no kind of emotionally naked, because he isn't naked in the movie, except for that one scene, and I think that there's a reason for that, that describes the character. Why he's never naked and she always is. I mean, that describes the dynamic of that relationship in that film. But there's no soul-bearing, kind of naked, more naked performance than Last Tango. It's a revelation. I think Last Tango is one of the last truly masterful performances in history, in the history of film.
Very true.
Godfather, very true. I mean, he wasn't above, obviously, using the theatrical tricks of putting on different facial stuff and, you know, using you know, everything he could to kind of build the character from the outside in.
Right.
I think that the only thing that tarnishes Brando's reputation, because, you know, the duds I can live with too. Everyone has them.
Yeah, I mean, you can't. Yeah, I mean, duds are there. You know, not everyone's going to hit a home run. You
it's
know?
His attitude towards the craft and towards his own talent. It's the dismissal of why everyone held him so dear, and it must have been a lonely place to live for him. You know, in Brando's head, because he dismissed everything. You know, a big chunk of what made him so special for so many people. But he didn't feel that way about himself. I think he probably did. I gather a lot of hypocrisy from Brando, from what I read about him. You know, I read this infamous Playboy interview he did in 1979 where he was adamant about not wanting to talk about any of the movies because he wanted to talk about the plight of the Indian and blah, 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 and his island in Tahiti. And so when the interviewer went that route, Brando himself would always return to the stories about the movies he did.
You have a point there.
Yeah, I think he was deeply kind of a disturbed man. And
he tried to slug Connie Chung once in an interview I remember in 1990 because
he's talking about ants crawling all. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, you know, she asked him a question about the American Indians. He's like, you know, I ought to slug you.
If only he had.
No, but then Maury Povich would have jumped in. I mean,
he kissed Larry King on the lips.
Yeah, that's true. That was a crazy interview.
He could have slugged Connie Chung. but we have De Niro, and we have Brando, and we have Sean Penn. You know, all of the, each
and
one...
And Pacino.
Begats the other. Yeah, that's the first person I mentioned, yeah, obviously. And Hoffman, and they all revere Brando. And there's a reason for it. Plus those guys in the 70s, if we talk about the great actors from our generation starting up, De Niro, Brando, Hoffman, Hackman, Duvall.
Nicholson.
Not typically handsome people. And Brando was very handsome when he started. But it was the 70s kind of... rebel youth kind of thinking outside the box thing that allowed them to cast and make stars out of people that weren't traditionally movie star handsome. And they weren't. I mean, they weren't the matinee idol look.
True.
Thank you.
I was just waiting. I mean, that's what I guess you were hoping to say, a chorus of approval. But
and people wanted to see actors on the screen that looked like them. I mean, it was about time.
And do they still want to see that, though?
Yeah. I think we want it both ways. I think that's it.
You just hit it. We do want it both ways.
Depends on what we're watching. I mean, there's movies, and then there's stuff that we watch that we don't necessarily want to escape in, but we want to relate to. And I think it requires both. It requires the traditional movie star handsome, like I think that George Clooney is. It requires somebody real looking, like, take your pick. Pick somebody.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Exactly.
There you go, Philip
exactly.
Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. So that's my stand on that.
That's your stand, and it's a stand that will...
Talk about overrated actors. Who do you think, because, Jerry, you and I had the conversation about whether or not George Clooney is a movie star earlier today.
Well, I have the reason, and I do, he is a movie star, but I also think he's also, let's put it like this. He has the classical Hollywood, old Hollywood, Cary Grant charisma, the looks.
And
but
the toughness of a Steve McQueen.
And the toughness, not of a Steve McQueen, really of a Robert Mitchum almost.
I would
go with Robert because he does. He evokes this old Hollywood. And the only other actor I think like that right now, like I said earlier on the phone, he was Aaron Eckhart to an extent. Yeah. But George Clooney has this, the Cary Grant, the Alan Ladd. If you want to go with Steve McQueen, that's definitely a very good choice.
See, I see Steve McQueen in him because he's most powerful when he's still, not necessarily when he has any dialogue, when you read his face. That's the kind of acting McQueen relished.
You're absolutely right. And I think that's very true in Michael Clayton,
yeah.
Especially the closing during the credits.
Yes.
I mean, that. And people, please, if you go see Michael Clayton, please stay for the credits. Please.
Yeah.
Without
revealing anything that's in the closing credits, I thought it would be like a terrific joke to leave that shot going till the very, very end. I thought, man, this is ballsy. I thought that's what it was going to do. Michael Clayton, very smart, intelligent, well-written movie. And I was speaking to someone else last night, to Aaron, about Michael Clayton. And he said, it's a great movie partly because every character comes through. And that's why it reminds you of those films of, back 30 years ago. Because
it does.
It's multi-layered. Every character comes through. You get to know his brother. You get to know his sister, his ex-wife, his son.
You get to know everyone. And I also think what's very nice is that Tom Wilkinson, obviously, is Arthur Edens, is giving the closest thing I've seen to Peter Finch's Howard
mm-hmm.
Beale in
Network.
Yeah,
there's definitely that.
I mean, it's got that. I think Tilda Swinton, who is a criminally underrated actress, comes through here. Sidney Pollack is very good. Their scenes together are wonderful.
Yeah, but Sidney Pollack is just a treasure as an actor.
As a treasure as an actor, as a director, but I think actually here, for the first thing I've seen him in a long time, I was like, God, he's perfect.
Yeah.
He's just great. I mean, those scenes together, but it's George as Michael Clayton. I mean, I think people will be able to relate to this. Here's this guy who's beaten down. He's just, it's like those great movies that we love from the 70s, but he's beaten down, and when he does get his chance.
Yeah.
I will say this, the last half hour is not just, I think, the finest acting of Clooney's career, would be the finest acting of any actor's career. I think his transition, I think what he does is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it really is about... Tom Wilkinson is in a place where he's outraged.
Yes.
Like you said, he has the Howard Beale part. Clooney has to go... Clooney, meanwhile, is disgusted. He's disgusted with himself. And it's about his transition to having that disgust morph into outrage.
Right.
And action. And that's powerful to watch. But it isn't told predictably.
Not at all.
And it's paced very deliberately. It's not a stand up and cheer movie like you're accustomed to with these kind of class action.
Yeah, classes. Not at all. Not at all.
It's all very smartly done and interior and not so obvious. But I respect it for that. It's very intelligent.
Oh, it's one of the most intelligent films I've seen this year.
Yeah. And you can really tell that he's a writer. I mean, Chris and I were just talking before the show about Tony Gilroy is behind the Bourne series.
Yes.
Screenwriter behind those films. And talk about films that their scripts elevate the genre. You know, they're not mindless.
No, they're not mindless. And I think they actually took, what I appreciate about Tony Gilroy and what he did with the Robert Ludlum books is he took them and made sure that they're, contemporary, because the books are dated. And he made them contemporary. He also made Jason Bourne a three-dimensional figure. I mean, a very, fleshed-out character. We appreciate that. We like him. We identify with him
right in
each film. And I think right there is a, wonderful writer at work.
Mm-hmm. So have you checked out anything else lately?
Well,
We Own the Night. You checked out
I did. We watched We Own the Night last night, and I think that's, once again, it's James Gray, who did Little Odessa and The Yards, and once again, like with The Yards, I think it's Joaquin Phoenix's film more so than Mark Wahlberg or Robert Duvall. They're good, but they're more plot devices.
Mm-hmm.
You could say it really, once again, it's Joaquin Phoenix's film. And it really rests on his performance, and he is very good. It's a decent movie. I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but it is a decent film. I think at times it tries too hard, and this is, I guess, a valid criticism of The Yards. It tries too hard to be like The Godfather, in the sense of with The Yards is in the sense of corruption, and this one about family and loyalty. But it's an interesting film. I think it's worth checking out.
It strikes me as a film that's come 20 years late. It seems like an 80s movie.
It's an 80s movie with a 70s feel. Does that make sense?
That's great.
You know what's interesting?
A 90s wardrobe.
You know that this guy... Did you know that James Gray is the inspiration for Billy Walsh on Entourage?
Really?
Really?
That's the rumor, yeah. That has always been the rumor.
Me and Mark
Wahlberg have been friends for years and years and years. And if you look at his movies, they do somewhat resemble, like, Queens Boulevard. For
yeah, Little Odessa, you could say, is like...
Uh-huh.
Wow, I never even thought that, because that's very interesting.
He's known to have a very volatile personality and uncompromising vision for his movies. So it's interesting to sit here and talk. I haven't seen the movie, but to sit and talk about his movies, I feel like Billy Walsh is going to show up and, like, bust through my window.
Yeah, I hope he doesn't, but that makes sense then. Only three movies in what has been since 94.
Mm.
Right.
That makes sense. Oh, God, Billy Walsh. I wonder if he's even going to be on the show next year.
Oh, he has to be. The show ended with them in cans.
Yeah.
I love the
Yeah, and Harvey got $1. Got it for $1.
There's an interesting piece of movie news from the past week or so. It's a movie that a lot of people are looking forward to. It was going to come out, I believe, early November maybe or late this month. Called The Kite Runner.
Yeah, it's been pushed back to December now.
Yeah, and it was based on a best-selling novel that a lot of people are crazy about, directed by Mark Forster, who did Monsters Ball and Finding Neverland. I guess there was a sensitive scene that tastefully, if you can use that word, depicted the rape of a 13-year-old boy or something.
Yes, and this is the guy was worried that he would be the actor, and this part was worried that he would be, he'd be killed. He's worried for his life
because he lives
in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
and they pushed it back to December 14th,
so they could transfer the whole family and the two boys back to the U.S. and give.
Oh, are they coming to the U.S.? Are they?
Yeah, they're transferring.
Okay,
transferring back.
I did not know that. Okay,
yeah, it's a very unusual position for a film to be in.
No pun intended.
No, but I was surprised that they pushed it back, but at least because I thought at first the way they were talking, they were actually going to push it off the slate, but they want this to be in for the Oscars.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because this got Oscar written all over it.
This is a high-profile book. And,
yes,
and
it
one
is.
Of our, one of our loyal listeners, Ty, it's his, I think it's one of his favorite books, and he's very much looking forward
Everyone loves this book.
Yeah, and I don't know anything about the project or the book except, the headlines. But apparently it's very moving. It's very profoundly moving, especially given this political climate that we're in today.
Right.
Overseas with Afghanistan and Iraq. More and more topical stuff coming up in films. It's encouraging. But this is a little price to pay, and this is a preview of some of the complexities of making movies that are so current, that deal with such current themes.
That, yes, and we have one of those films comes out this week on Rendition.
Yeah.
About the CIA prisons. And then in a couple of weeks, we do have Lions for Lambs finally comes out November 9th.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see how they fare.
Lions for Lambs will be interesting. I'm really looking forward to it. And I do think Mission Impossible 3 suffered from the Tom Cruise fallout.
I think we're past that though now. I think we're ready.
But I'm hoping that we are past it with Lions for Lambs.
Doesn't he play a Republican senator?
Yes.
So he is playing against type.
My God, that boy can act.
I read an interview with Robert Redford, and it does sound very interesting. And he has definitely gone back to his political roots with this film.
Yeah.
And I'm very curious.
Expect another Redford performance that's made up of bumper sticker dialogue.
You love saying that. In the interview I was reading with him, I was thinking, everything is a bumper sticker.
It really is. I understand you help people with horse problems. Truth is, I help horses with people problems. Everything that comes out of his mouth has to be so clever, like a bumper sticker. I love Robert Redford. Don't get me wrong. I think he's an effortless actor without any range whatsoever. I think he's an even better director. And I think he has incredible range as a director and insight. But come on. I mean, do you have to be Yoda in every movie you do?
Or in every interview you do. He did say something very interesting. Because I guess he got an award, and he was, and the President Bush gave it to him, I guess last year or the year before, a medal that he got. And he went to the dinner afterwards, and it was Republicans and Democrats together, and he says, it's really strange, during the day they're at each other's throats, but, it's really weird to see them, like Ted Kennedy and with Senator Bill Frist, patting each other on the back, joking around, and he says it's like just all theater. And he said he developed this a huge amount of cynicism even now towards the current political climate. He just says that I don't think he likes the Democrats or the Republicans.
Mm.
He was actually shocked by this. He just said it's all just a huge show.
Yeah.
And he was really, this caught him off guard, and it was interesting.
Speaking of interesting, Chris, did you have a chance to watch the video footage of De Palma's New York Film Festival press conference exchange?
No, I didn't. What happened?
He was on a panel there with a representative.
It was classic.
And he was asked by a journalist. They asked, I understand that your film itself has been redacted, which is something that I've heard in interviews. It's a clever question. And he says, "Yes, the imagery montage at the end of my film that shows the bodies of dead Iraqis and that kind of thing. They blackened it out and they deleted some of them, some of the more powerful ones. And his whole take on the redacted thing is, he said that the American people were knowledgeable of how terrible the Vietnam skirmish was, based on the photos that came back home, the uncensored, dramatic, blood-soaked photographs. That really brought it home, and it led to an urgency to end that war. he said, we're not seeing those images of Iraq, and it's happening. And so that's what he wanted to do as a movie maker. You know, like him or not, agree with politics or not. That was his motive for the movie. So when the legality of the photos that were being used in the movie was under scrutiny, and he made it very clear during this press conference that Magnolia, mostly right at the top, Mark Cuban, who he named, caved. At which point, a voice in the back of the theater said, "That's not true," and it was a representative from Magnolia, who said that, "Where else could you have made this film?" And he said, "No, who else would make this film?" And De Palma said, "I made this film." He said, "No, but who else would release it?" And De Palma said, which I don't agree with, "A lot of people would release it." And there was a back and forth exchange. Basically, they're frightened. Their argument is they can easily be sued for using photographs of, and family members can see their dead relative. Iraqi relative, and they can sue, and they have no legal recourse. It's a complex issue, and De Palma's very PO'd about it and feels very defeated because it deadens the impact that he wanted his film to have at the place in the movie where it should have the most impact, at the very end. So that's the story about the New York Film Festival.
Yeah,
go ahead, Jerry.
Sorry. No, please, Chris. You...
No. I hadn't completely organized my thoughts yet. This is the first I've heard of this.
Oh, okay.
So.
I just, you know, he kept bringing up, if, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Jamie, but he kept bringing up that they shouldn't have been redacted because those photos were on the internet.
Yes.
And yes. I don't know. See, legally, I don't know if he's right or not because they're on the internet. If he can use them in the film,
I don't know if they're fair use if they've already been published on the internet.
And you're watching it, and then another producer came on stage.
Yeah,
and he was actually you know very supportive of De Palma.
He tried to be very respectful of, and the producer at the back of the house made a point too, which was a smartsy response. But he basically said, "I feel like it goes right to the theme of the movie, redacted."
Yes.
I think it's more powerful to have those photos redacted.
He may very well be right there. I think De Palma sort of, I have to say, De Palma sort of looked like, didn't come out looking good in this.
When does he?
Well, yeah. I know that's a good point right there. But we have a possibility for his first film that very for him at least, and maybe for his. Critically, could be a very important film for him, although the reviews have not been promising so far.
I've read half and half. It seems like a big love it or hate it movie.
I think that's what it's going to be. It's going to be quite, you're either going to love it or hate it.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, no, I wasn't talking.
It's what you come to expect from De Palma, though. You don't expect a people-pleasing movie. You expect a polarizing film.
It's never a people-pleasing movie.
Yeah. That's where he exists. He exists on the fringes. He's polarizing. You love him or hate him.
Right.
I don't think he's comfortable any other way.
If he's not now, he never will be.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my take. It's still a film that we're all looking forward to seeing or have an interest in seeing. Right?
Yeah, I hope it will get a wider release than the typical Magnolia films using this platform.
Yeah,
I really do. I hope they're going to take advantage of the topical nature and try to release it to a lot of theaters.
I just can't see that happening. I mean, with all this heat around this movie and, like you said, mixed reviews, De Palma doesn't have a great track record, certainly not at the box office in the last 10 years, I think this movie's going to end up getting buried, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of the thing is if you have, I guess, I don't know who carries it, but if you have HDNet channel, you'll be able to watch it the day it is released.
Right.
So I don't know if they have a wide release.
I don't think that it's a movie, though, that I don't think that the Cuban's company is a company that's designed to release anything wide. I don't
exactly.
care how high profile it is.
Right.
Any movie that's been released on HD has not intentionally, but it has been buried. Whether it's the Bubble, the Steven Soderbergh movie, or the other one, the Morgan Freeman thing.
Well, look, this reminds me a lot of what Scorsese, what happened to Scorsese with The Last Temptation of Christ.
That's true.
Yeah, and Scorsese and De Palma are close, I believe. I think there's a lot of one-upmanship between the two of them, actually. Because I remember De Palma talking about Raging Bull, and he felt really good about whatever the last movie he did was, whether it was Dressed to Kill or whatever it was.
I think it was Dressed to Kill.
And then he saw Raging Bull and the opening shot of De Niro in the ring with the music in slow motion and the stark black and white, and he said, oh, God, back to the drawing board.
That's true.
It's a good-natured kind of back and forth. But it reminds me of that. I don't know that if theaters showed it in the red states here, where we live, if people would threaten to burn the theaters. They did that with Last Temptation.
I remember that. It was crazy.
Years ago, I mean, here in little Lakeland, Florida, there was a movie theater that was going to show it, and some members of the church came by the theater and said, if you show this, we'll burn your theater down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and mass picketing, and really attention that movie otherwise would not have gotten. And it's become infamous as a result of those actions. And I think that's probably what's happening with Redacted. Would anyone know about Redacted or necessarily care about Redacted if Bill O'Reilly wasn't talking about it every night?
I don't.
And misrepresenting what it is? I mean, I have no problem if you have a problem with the movie. I might have a problem with the movie. You know, it seems like, you know, propaganda goes both ways.
Right.
If you're not telling a fair-sighted story, you know, you could be Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter. But Bill O'Reilly reporting that, you know, the pictures at the end of the movie are of dead American soldiers. None of the pictures at the end are dead American soldiers.
What is he, you know,
dead Iraqis. Well, because dead American soldiers makes people more outraged.
Yeah, but that we know, the three of us know that's a flat-out lie. It's not dead American soldiers.
Well, maybe he just doesn't know. But
I don't think
his
he
job
knows, and he's just a troublemaker.
and so is De Palma.
Well, De Palma's a troublemaker, and you said something, and Jamie, bless your heart, you said something very true. The propaganda thing goes both ways.
Yeah.
Has he made a movie that just is so on one side that it's, you know, it's like it's too much on that side, which doesn't matter what the side is, but it's just so extremist that it's just doesn't work?
Yeah. Look, I might think, I mean, let me just say it. I think that we should get out. I mean, I think there was a mistake, but there's got to be good things happening there. I mean, the Americans are there. I'm sure they're doing wonderful things for people. There are two sides to everything. There are different shades, I doubt very seriously that that's being depicted in De Palma's film, from what I've read.
Yeah, I agree with you there. From what I've read, it's very, from what I know so far, at least, it's very one-sided.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work.
But political films, I mean, it's a heck of a thing to be a critic and trying to review a political film. And not stray, you know.
It's hard. I mean, yeah. I remember reading A.O. Scott's review of Fahrenheit 9/11, and it's very, you know, just reading the review, you know, he's very anti, A.O. Scott's very anti-Bush.
What a careful movie how careful do you have to be when you review a movie like Fahrenheit 9/11?
I know, it's weird, but, you know, you just, it comes out, though. It just,
yeah.
When you're reviewing a film like that, it just comes out, or An Inconvenient Truth, that comes out if you agree with Al. It's just unavoidable. It just comes.
They usually end up making some, like, you know, a couple paragraphs in, making some direct statement about their feelings on whatever the issue is, in order to avoid, you know, beating around the bush. They usually come out and say something like, look, I have no love for the war in Iraq, or, you know, and then they follow it up with, you know, their reasons to why the movie is good or
right.
Not.
Yeah. It's a quagmire. You know, and Michael Moore, I was crazy about Fahrenheit 9/11. I was like most people that saw it. I was really riled up. You know, but it helped that he said at the outset that it's a film of propaganda. But it's very telling to me as well that any time you question any of Michael Moore's points, he folds. He does fold. He says, well, you know, that doesn't answer all the other points I made.
Right.
it's, you know, it's a little dicey. I mean, Michael Moore's word isn't God.
No, and that's very important that you bring. None of these filmmakers, or they're not. They're the filmmakers, the artist's opinion.
Yeah.
First and foremost, they're not God. That's a very important point to bring up.
The big thing on Michael Moore's side, and we've discussed this in the past, is that he is a hell of a filmmaker.
Yes.
He knows how to make a film, and with that comes a sense of persuasion too. With the power of the filmmaker, I mean that's the filmmaker's job is to manipulate. That's how you know you're a good filmmaker.
Yeah.
And he is a good filmmaker.
Yeah, I mean there's no doubt. These are very important points. I wish someone would have brought these points up for a couple of these political films, because these are polemics. These are video polemics, and that's what needs to be said. These are just opinions. It's not fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people, and I'm guilty of this too in my past, you know, confusing it for fact. I think we've all made that mistake at one time or another.
Yeah, and you know, I've had occasion where after the movie I've seen instances where if someone questioned the movie, Fahrenheit, someone else would, you know, Chris, I think you know what I'm talking about, would kind of curse them and say, how dare you? How can you possibly say that? Well, it's American to question. And you know, it's smart to question. And I think that was Michael Moore's point in making the movie. So he shouldn't take offense to people that do it in turn after watching his movie.
Right.
Anyway, so we've had an enlightening conversation, and our guest did not call in, obviously, but we're very excited to speak with him and get a perspective on what it takes to put together a film festival.
I want to know how they decide how they come to decide some of the films.
Yeah, he gets like, I think 1 year he got over 700 submissions. And that's a lot. And from that he has to call like 200. I did all the work on writing up the interview and doing my research and everything. So all that's done, so it's just a matter of getting him on the show. But we do have a roster of terrific guests. If you haven't checked out our past shows, we just interviewed John Badham, the director of Saturday Night Fever.
That last show was a lot of fun.
You know what? That was a fantastic time discussing Badham's career and his insights into directing actors. We could have spent the whole hour with him. Next time we might do that. Just great shows, Joe Pantoliano, like we mentioned before, and Howard Shore, who composed the Lord of the Rings films and all of Cronenberg's work. Great past shows. So go through our archives and just comb it over and see what suits your fancy. And feel free to send us an email or let us know how we're doing, moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com, or you can join our friends page at myspace.com/moviegeeksunited. Guys, it's been fun. And we'll see you on Wednesday night.
Yeah, it was a great time tonight.
We're going to close off with a little promo for our Kubrick show next Sunday. Chris, you're crazy about Kubrick.
Oh, I can't wait for it, actually.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to it.
Eyes Wide Shut, I mean, these are people that untapped resources, so it's that really can tell us something about Kubrick, both as a director of actors and as a collaborator. Technically, it's going to be great. So here's a little promo for next week, and then we'll close the show out with some music. Here you go.
You could be a modern art masterpiece.
Here's to 5 miserable months on the wagon and all the irreparable harm that it's caused me.
When a promise has been made here, there is no turning back.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I'm singing in the rain.
Special 1-hour tribute to director Stanley Kubrick, featuring interviews with Eyes Wide Shut actress Julian Davis and cinematographer Larry Smith. Sunday, October 21st at 6 p.m. Eastern.
I was cured, all right.
All right, guys. That's it for tonight. Jerry, Chris, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Everyone have a good week.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.